Hello and welcome to the IEA channel. I'm Emma Revel, Head of Public Affairs, and before we get started, I want to take a moment to remind you that you can subscribe to the IEA podcast, available on Apple, Spotify or Podbean, and on our YouTube channel, so you're the first to discover all of our digital output. Socialism remains a hugely popular idea among Western millennials, but mention a specific example of socialism in the presence of a true believer, and you'll be sure to get a lot of wailing and gnashing of teeth. That's not real socialism, they'll cry. Today, we're joined by two people who have spent some time in the socialist utopia of yesteryear, Venezuela. Jesus Amas is a Venezuelan politician and activist who spent most of his life there and who is currently in the process of setting up a libertarian think tank in the country. Roberto White is a British-Venezuelan student of politics and international studies at the University of Warwick and who lived in Venezuela from 2004 to 2010. Both are part of the IEA's internship programme, and if you want to find out more about that, the information is available on our website. We're also joined by Dr. Christian Niemitz, who's the IEA's Head of Political Economy and whose book, Socialism, a Failed Idea That Never Dies, contains a chapter on the attitudes of Western intellectuals towards Venezuela's socialist experiment. So welcome all three of you. Thanks very much for joining me. A question to Jesus and Rob first. Venezuela was in the news a lot quite a few years ago in the UK when the country's humanitarian crisis escalated. But since then, things have quietened down from a UK perspective. What is the situation like now? Is it that the situation has stabilised, or has, you know, the UK news just moved on? And what is it like living under the once framed socialism of the 21st century?
Well, Emma, let me tell you that in the middle of a pandemic, it's really difficult to stay in news. Every country has their own domestic problems right now, but the situation in Venezuela is every day worse. Just a few weeks ago, the High Commissioner for the Human Rights of the United Nations released a report talking about the human rights violation in the country. For example, in the report, they talk about tortures, about extrajudicial execution by the security forces of the country. They talk about rapes. They talk about the humanitarian situation of the Venezuelan right now. For example, in this moment, the people from Venezuela don't have drinking water. They suffer every day from blackout. One person in Venezuela can have 8 or maybe 10 hours a day without electricity. We don't have a gasoline in this moment in the country. We have shortages of gasoline. And that's really crazy, because Venezuela is the country with the largest reserve of oil in all the country. We have more oil than Saudi Arabia. And we have the second more largest gasoline refinery in all the world. And we don't have gas for cooking, and that made that people right now is cooking with firewood. Is living in the socialist of 21st century is to travel to the past. We are living in a country with the condition of the final days of the 19th century is really terrible.
Thank you. Bob, would you agree?
Yeah, no, I mean, completely. He touched on a lot of good points, but I think the one that has to be focused on is the fact that we have a shortage of petroleum. I mean, as Jesus said, we have the largest reserves in the world. And I remember a few years back, because half of my family is still in Venezuela, and they would say, you know, I would fill up the gas tanks either here in Texas, and it would cost me between 40 and 50 pounds. But over there, it was so cheap. It was almost like they were giving it away. And I used to think, God, that is, you know, it's so great that it's cheap, obviously ignoring all the bad economics behind that. But now there's a shortage of that. And that sort of makes me think, you know, when the government is saying we're going to give you all this free stuff, how long is that sustainable for? And I think the answer with Venezuela is that not at all, because, I mean, it doesn't make sense for such a wealthy country to be so poor, but that's the situation.
Venezuela had populist governments before Chavez, and plenty of other countries also in the region and elsewhere have had populist governments. Economic populism, as we know, isn't great. It doesn't lead to fantastic outcomes, and there's a lot of needless economic damage that can come with it, but it doesn't usually lead to a full-blown humanitarian crisis that you two are describing. So what was so uniquely bad about Chavez and Maduro that has led to this situation in Venezuela?
Well, Emma, let me tell you, 1958 and 1998, Venezuela lived under a democratic regime that made an economy that relied only on the prices of the oil. Between 1958 and 1970, the prices of oil were really high, and Venezuela was a really prosperous country. But after the prices of oil declined, Venezuela and the Venezuelan people start to feel discontent, and they choose Chavez by a democratic election. And he never, in that campaign, sell himself as a socialist candidate. But just after he won the election in 1998, he started to apply, to impose socialist policies. For example, he make controls of exchange, control of prices. He expropriate thousands of enterprises and business in the country. For example, he nationalized the oil industry. He expropriates companies and ExxonMobil, ConocoPhillips, but he also expropriate supermarkets. He expropriate toilet paper industry. That was something that turns the country onto socialist and also destroy the economy. It's really sad that a country that had so much potential is right now living, the people is living under a minimum wage that is around $1 a month. It's a real tragedy. And right now, there is also a lot of repression in the country. If you combine socialist policies in the economics and repression, you have the perfect storm, and you have, and we have right now the most terrible humanitarian crisis in all the world, and the second largest immigration crisis in all the planet, just after the Syrian crisis. More than 5 million Venezuelans have left the countries in the four last years.
I mean, that's an astonishing amount of people trying to escape. Rob, would you agree it's the perfect storm, as Jesus put it?
Yeah, no, completely. And it's almost as if the goal was to create the worst possible scenario, Chavez and Maduro ticked off all the boxes. Because when you look at why the country is the way it is in terms of economics, there's the nationalization, as Jesus said. But the problem with that is that, especially with the oil company, Chavez replaced all the people in important positions, not with engineers, not with geologists, with just loyalists who would say yes to whatever Chavez ordered them to. And you can't run a company with the interest of the president as your main business goal. Your main business goal should be to make a profit and to continue your operations. And so this led to a lot of capital flight, because private businesses obviously weren't assured that they were going to continue their operations. And then another thing that Jesus said was the social projects. Chavez believed that the price of oil was going to be at 80 to 100 barrels of $80 to $100, you know, forever. And so he would put the Venezuelan expenditure at that price. The problem is that, you know, completely denies how the global oil market works. It fluctuates, it goes up and down. So when the price of oil got to $40 a barrel, you know, the reserves started drying up, because how are we going to pay for all this debt? So one of the main problems was the fact that he was spending a lot of money on social programs while simultaneously getting rid of all of the capital, all the private capital that could be used to fund these programs. So it was just economic incompetence, essentially.
Christian, I'll bring you in. Venezuela used to have a lot of Western cheerleaders, even if a lot of them deny it now. You've written about it extensively in your book, as I mentioned in the introduction. Where did this Venezuela mania come from?
Well, before Chavez, there was almost no interest in Venezuela in the Western media. When I wrote the paper, I looked at various newspaper archives, and from the years before Chavez, there's basically nothing. Then, when Chavez was first elected, it doesn't immediately change drastically. You can find a handful of Guardian articles from about his first term in office, but those articles are not enthusiastic yet. They're quite descriptive, quite neutral. That's because they don't know what to make of him yet. They're a bit confused by him. They don't really know how to describe his political ideology. They certainly don't call him a socialist, and that's because he doesn't do that himself at that stage. As Jesus already said, he doesn't initially call himself a socialist. He doesn't use that word at all until 2005, in fact. You get the situation in the Western media changes a bit after the military coup of 2002, because now Chavez is sort of the underdog, and now for the Guardian and papers like that, he ticks the right boxes. So from then on, you get a lot more Venezuela coverage, and the tone changes a lot. Now it's much more sympathetic. Now the Guardian is clearly fully on Chavez's side. So there are, at that point, you can find the first Western Chavistas, but these are usually people from the old school left. It's people like Ken Livingstone, it's people like Ken Loach, but the trendy hipster left is not yet really on board with it. That only starts in 2005 when Chavez starts to call himself a socialist, and he does that in a particular way. He's particular catchphrase, which is socialism of the 21st century, and that becomes an overnight success. A couple of months later, that becomes the New York Times uses that phrase in headlines. In 2005, Chavez gives a talk at the World Social Forum, which is a gathering of anti-capitalist groups, and there he talks about his socialism of the 21st century. It immediately becomes an overnight success. He becomes the star of that event. A couple of days later, there's an article in The Guardian with the title, Hugo Chavez, Superstar. And it's true, he really is a superstar from that moment onwards. A year later, he travels to Europe and gives a talk in Vienna, and thousands of people turn up. Now, this is quite extraordinary, because that's it. If you think about what would have happened if this had been the president of Peru or the president of Colombia, how many people would have turned up to listen to them? Maybe a few expats, maybe a few Latin America specialists. But in Vienna, they really have thousands of people turning up. It's like a Corbyn rally, basically, except it's 10 years too early and in the wrong city. But from then on, it is a thing. A year later, The Guardian talks about revolutionary tourism. They talk about how Caracas is swamped with Western backpackers, Western tourists who travel there specifically because they want to see the new socialist utopia firsthand. They want to travel to the new Mecca of socialism. And then from a couple of years later, the 2010s, if you look at the publications of groups like the Venezuela Solidarity Campaign in Britain, the people who they quote with pro-Venezuela statements, it's basically like a who is who of the British left. So Owen Jones is, of course, one of them, travels there several times and then writes enthusiastic articles about Chavismo. Half of Corbyn's shadow cabinet is part of it, or Corbyn's then future shadow cabinet, now ex. And it's people like Diane Abbott, John McDonnell, Corbyn himself, obviously, Richard Bergen, and all the general secretaries of all the big trade unions. So the Trades Union Congress, Unite the Union, Unison, Communication Workers Union, they're all part of this pro-Venezuela crowd. And it's particularly interesting to look at what it is that they're saying. Because if you say something positive about foreign government, that doesn't mean that you agree with everything they do. or that you are, or that you want your own country to be exactly like that. If I say, for example, that housing is cheap in Texas, that land use planning policy in Texas is a good thing, that doesn't mean that I want Britain to be like Texas. I'm praising one specific thing, but the Venezuela cheerleaders are not like that. They never just talk about individual policies. They always talk about Venezuela as a model. They say Venezuela shows that there is an alternative. Venezuela shows that a different world is possible. They always talk about it in those grand narrative terms. So they really see it as something that isn't just a success story, as they then see it, in its own right, but something that we in the West should actively learn from and try to emulate. Owen Jones says this literally in some talk where he says, it's very important to me that we don't just think of Venezuela as something that's happening elsewhere, but as a model that gives us all hope. So therefore, this focus on the catchphrase, socialism of the 21st century, the main claim is that Venezuela is the living proof that socialism does work and that it can be totally different.
So, Jesus and Rob, having lived under socialism, specifically the Venezuelan socialism, how does it feel to have Western hipsters basically tell you that socialism is great and you just don't understand it? I mean, we start with Rob.
I'm in my final year at Warwick, and when I first got to Warwick, they have these fairs, society's fairs, when you go and look around, and I remember that. But just by coincidence, at that point, I hadn't really solidified my political views, but I walked past the conservative stall, and they had these sort of like fake money that said, it was something like Chavez will give you a lot of these, or Maduro will give you a lot of these, you know, emphasizing the fact that they're just printing so much money and inflation is terrible. And just from that, I was like, well, if they're making fun and ridiculing Maduro, that's who I want to join. But then, so I started joining the Conservative Society, but I also met a lot of people who were on the left wing of the spectrum. And initially I was shocked because I've never, you know, I know that socialism doesn't work. And I don't have to, you know, even if I was a Venezuelan, I would still know this. Yet I was, shocked at the persistence of these people to defend this ideology. And it's not just socialism. You know, some people say, oh, well, you know, social democrat, democratic socialism. But there's a lot of Marxists and actual communists. And when you get into that territory, it's a bit like, well, do you actually know what this word means? Because I'm sure a lot of people, when I think of communism, it's Mao, it's Stalin, it's Pol Pot, and that's not something that I'd like to be aligned with. And so initially you try to reason with them. You say, okay, well, why do you believe what you believe? And what I've realized is the arguments for socialism are very rarely rooted in actual economics. And if they are, it's not good economics. It's an emotional plea. It's people who they see, for example, this whole thing with Marcus Rashford, right? The kids are going hungry. So what's the solution? The government has to give them food. The government cannot let billionaires exist whilst, kids are going hungry. And when I started to realize that, you essentially come to the realization that you can't win against them because they're not willing to have a rational discussion. They're not willing to understand that, you know, supply and demand works in a certain way. If you force private businesses and tax them at 90%, they are going to go away to a place with lower taxes. And a lot of these programs that you want to fund, like free education, free housing, you need to have a robust economy from which you can, derive some income to then invest in it, right? So they don't realize how it actually works. So essentially, the position I've taken now after a few years at university is, people, because I have a lot of left-wing friends, they say, oh, you know, I like Corbyn, I think socialism's great. I tell them, well, I respectfully disagree. And what I found is that when I then say, oh, I'm actually half Venezuelan, they usually are like, oh, yeah, you know, I understand where you're coming from. But if it was just a person from London, an Englishman, saying, oh, you know, capitalism is the best alternative, they sort of look in hesitation. But the facts don't change. Whether I'm half British, half Venezuelan, or German like Christian, the fact is that socialism has destroyed Venezuela and tons of other countries.
Jesus, how do you feel when you see people with sort of Chavez t-shirts and holding it up like it's a good idea? I mean, you know it's not, but it must hurt to see that, right?
I feel sad for them because The truth is there. They believe on an utopia. They believe in something that doesn't exist, that is not true. I can tell you, Emma, if some of these hipsters with the teachers of Chavez or with the teachers of the Che Guevara spends like a month in the Venezuela poorest neighborhoods, you can see them in 1 month or in two change that teacher of the Che Guevara for one of Margaret Thatcher. Living in a country with 60,000% of inflation only in 2018 is something that you can describe it, because it's a tragedy. We were a prosperous country. Right now, we are in an humanitarian crisis. And that is really difficult to understand if you don't live there.
Yeah. I mean, if people can't see it, it's hard to fully understand the impact. Suppose, hypothetically, Venezuela manages to get rid of the Maduro government and a brand new cross-party alliance is formed. Jesus is a politician, might even be part of it. But they may come to you, they come to the three of you and say, look, we want you to be our economic advisors. How do we begin the post-socialist recovery of Venezuela? What would you be suggesting that we do? And we'll start with Jesus as a politician.
Okay, that's a great question, Emma, because that question gives me a lot of hope, because I know that with the right policies, Venezuela could be the first great miracle of the 21st century. Because there's not so much to improve or to innovate. There are a lot of policies that can change Venezuela from poverty to be a great country again. For example, we have to prioritize freedom, to prioritize economic freedoms as our plan. We have to abolish exchange control. We have to abolish price control. We have to respect and to promote property rights. We have to learn from countries as Germany what they do after the war. But there is not also, and there is not only Germany. There are examples here in the UK, for example, with all the privatization that Margaret Thatcher made in their time. We have to privatize all the companies. We have to deregulate and to open the market of oil. And we have a lot of potential in energy. We have a lot of natural resources that can be used, but that's not the important thing. The important thing is that in Venezuela, we have a great human resources. We have a great human capital. We have an entrepreneurial spirit that can be the real engine of the prosperity of the country. What I will advise to every president, not only in Venezuela, is to defend the economic freedom, to promote the economic freedom, and of course to promote human rights. If you combine democracy, individual freedom, and of course economic freedom, you can have a great country.
Rob, you were nodding along to a few points of that answer there. What would your sort of key recommendations be?
Yeah, so this is something I've spoken about with my dad, because he was the reason I lived there, and he worked for BP in 30 years almost. My focus would be the oil industry. You have to privatize most of it, I would say. Maybe keep some of it in the state hands, but it has to go into private control. I mean, I think most of us would agree that private entrepreneurs have the best incentive to see a company succeed, and they usually tend to be. So that would be the focus. But on a side note related to that, you have to reform the judiciary. And why do I say this? Because for a long time, most multinational oil companies, but most prominently Exxon, tried for years and years to get their money back. And the courts wouldn't rule in their favor. So you need an independent judiciary so that investor confidence can be reestablished, so that the money does flow in. And I think once the oil industry is recovered, then you can start working on all the things that Jesus said, such as economic liberalism, private property rights, and human rights. So,
Christian, anything to add to that? What would the sort of key focus be?
Nothing substantial to add. It would be the short-term program. That would be the easy part. In the beginning, a post-socialist government in Venezuela wouldn't really need specific policies of their own. They would just have to reverse bad policies of the Chavez-Maduro years. So in the beginning, it's relatively easy. In the beginning, you just undo things. You don't do things, you reverse things. You abolish price controls. You abolish exchange rate controls. You reverse confiscations and expropriations and nationalizations. You reprivatize things. To get out of the immediate crisis should then be relatively easy, because, or at least much easier than historic post-socialist transitions. It would not be like Eastern Europe in the 90s, because there they had a situation where they didn't have markets anymore, they didn't have private entrepreneurship anymore, it was extinct and they had to reinvent it from scratch. Venezuela wouldn't be like that. The basic institutions would still be there. There still is a private sector, there still is private entrepreneurship, it's just dormant at the moment. It would be a matter of reactivating something that is already there rather than building something completely new from scratch. So getting out of the immediate crisis would therefore be relatively easy, but regaining the lost prosperity, that's a different story, because there you'd have to essentially try to rebuild all the independent institutions. If you have institutions that are that used to be relatively independent of the government and that became politicized in the Chavez-Maduro years, that's a lot harder to reverse. These are the things that are easily destroyed and hard to rebuild. Getting back to an independent judicial system, a functioning rule of law, getting investors to trust you again, showing that we are under new management and we're not going to interfere with your business as long as you play by the rules, signaling that that's just going to be tough.
One final question for you all. We've talked about how Venezuela should be an example to socialists everywhere, a sort of warning of this is what can happen. Venezuela's no longer a democracy today, but Chavez was democratically elected initially, and he was genuinely popular at the beginning. So how can we prevent, or what do we need to be aware of to prevent the reemergence of a new Chavez, either in Venezuela or indeed in any country? What do we need to be aware of, and what do we need to do to make sure this doesn't happen anywhere else? Christian, we'll start with you.
Right. Yes, specifically in Venezuela, I guess it would really be they have to get the oil money out of politics, out of day-to-day politics, because the populace predates Chavez. What happened, my reading of the situation is that in the 60s already, the government was swimming in oil money and used that money to build up a client state, a patronage economy. And that got worse than even in the 70s while during the oil price boom. And what happens then is you create an expectation. People expect the government to, the government tries to buy support with its oil resources, and people get used to that. And people expect the government to create jobs or create all sorts of social programs for them. And you then run into trouble when oil prices decline, which is then what happened in the 80s and 90s. Oil prices were low. The government could no longer provide that standard that people had got used to. And then you get the emergence of populism, of people who just don't accept that. They're saying, no, it's all just a matter of political will. The money is there. The government just doesn't want to spend it. It's all about getting the right kind of politician in place, and then Chavez became that politician. And he was lucky, of course, because then, as soon as he took office, oil prices went up again, and then he could actually fulfill those promises. So I guess the closest counter example, the best example for having an oil industry, but without that messing up domestic policies, domestic politics, would be Norway, because they also have a huge amount of oil wealth, but it's relatively independent of politics. It's not Norwegian politicians who control that oil wealth. The money goes into a sovereign wealth fund, which is independent of politics, and it can't be used for day-to-day spending. Rather, it's used to fund the pension system, And if Norwegian politicians want to promise expensive social programs for day-to-day spending, well, they have to raise taxes like governments everywhere. They can't directly access the oil money, and that would be something, a problem that that Venezuela would have even if they privatized the oil industry, because that's this oil-funded populism is something that predates even the nationalization of the oil industry. The oil industry in Venezuela was private until the mid-70s, but even then, the government collected a lot of money from selling oil concessions, collecting royalties, using that money to become a sort of super entrepreneur. The government then was creating employment programs and setting up public sector companies. So even then, even when it was still private, they were using the oil money to intervene in the economy in all sorts of ways, setting up this massive client state. And that can only really be solved by getting the oil money out of politics, creating this completely separate fund which politicians cannot interfere with. And then about the Western world, there is no way around confronting socialism as an idea. It's not just about coming up with solutions, with genuine solutions to the downsides of capitalism, even though that is part of it, but it's also, we have to remind socialists every time that previous waves of socialist projects used to say the same thing that they say today. If you look at the early Chavez rhetoric, I mentioned this speech 2005 at the World Social Forum where he launches this project, Socialism of the 21st Century. If you look at if you listen to what he said at the time, it sounds just like any millennial socialist today. He doesn't say very clearly what his socialism of the 21st century is. I think in that stage he doesn't know that himself yet, but he's very clear about what it isn't. He says repeatedly, when I say socialism, I don't mean anything like the Soviet Union. It will be totally different. He literally calls the Soviet Union a perversion of socialism. So he distances himself from all the earlier attempts and says this will be totally different. This will be a humanitarian socialism, a socialism of the people, and it will be thoroughly democratic. All the rhetoric that we hear from the millennial socialists today, it's one-to-one, exactly the same as what Chavez said at the time. And so it's just not true if socialists in 2020 act as if their ideas had never been there before, or as if what they're doing is somehow novel and has nothing to do with these earlier failed attempts. They started with the exact same intentions. That is the point to highlight.
Rob, what do you think? How do we make sure that this isn't repeated in Venezuela or anywhere else?
Specific to Venezuela, I think one of the biggest things was you have to reform the Electoral Commission, because I think I remember it was the election in 2014, I think it was, or in 08, I'm not sure. But essentially, the votes were rigged, and the votes were proven to be rigged. In fact, I remember going to a station with my mom so she could vote. And, we were waiting outside, and before the voting had finished, these military soldiers went into the station, and then they came out with, like, ballots. And so, you have to make sure that the Electoral Commission is independent and not headed by a crony person, so that people like Chavez and Maduro don't get reelected. They're appointed. And then, on another side, what I said before, make sure the judiciary is independent so that any disputes can be resolved properly. And with regards to the West, I completely agree with Christian on this. I remember reading this book by this professor, Leif Wainar. He's actually at KCL. And he essentially likened having vast amounts of oil, similar to alcoholism. So it's not the best analogy, but in the way that, some alcoholics like Winston Churchill and John F. Kennedy became heads of state, you have the Norways, that they have a lot of oil, but they know somehow to function well with it. But unfortunately, for the vast amount of people, alcoholism is sadly a very troubling thing. And that's the Venezuelans, that's all the other oil-rich nations. So, it is really about what institutions do you have that allow you to best manage the resources. But I will say this, that even though I completely disagree with socialists, I do think it's good for them to be in this discourse, talking like at universities and all that. But I just don't want them to be in power. And I think recent events with Rishi Sunak spending all this money, people are saying, well, you know, if he can spend the money now, why shouldn't this be the norm? Well, just look at the government debt that we're in, and that should answer it quite clearly. So I just think the main thing is being educated, making sure that you know, first of all, what are you trying to achieve, and is the socialist method the best way to achieve it? But in Venezuela, yeah, you have to change a lot of things.
And Jesus, we'll let you have the final comments. What safeguards do you think we need to put in place?
Okay, I think we have to look for things. The first one is to divide the power as much as we can. Chavez was really strong because, and Maduro is really strong because he has the army, he has the political power, he has the economic power of the country, and he also has the Supreme Court. We have to prevent that, dividing the power in all the countries, in all democracy. The second thing we have to do is to have really, really strong institutions. We need a really strong Supreme Court, a really limited government, but strong in their basic functions. Number three, I think we need a really strong business sector, private sector, because that helps the society to have more power and to the government be more limited. And for the fourth thing, and maybe the most important of all, is to educate people to talk about these topics. And for that, we need more institutions like the Institution of Economic Affairs in all the planet to talk about free markets, to talk about economic freedom, but also to talk about liberalism and individual freedom and the importance to accomplish that freedom to have a really human progress.
I mean, that seems like a fantastic plan, and we will obviously keep doing our best, as I know will you. Thank you very much, Rob, Christian and Jesus, for joining me. If you'd like to find out more about the IEA's work, you can visit our website, iea.org.uk, where you can find all of our podcasts, videos, research, media, and information about our internship programme. You can also donate and make a contribution to support the IEA's work if that's something that you're interested in. Thank you very much.